And now it's time for the futures.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome to the show. Happy Future Tuesday on this cloudy yet magnificent day in Santa Cruz.
We've got some great stories for you this week, not the least of which is a little field trip that Mrs. Future went on a few days ago to Asilomar and the future of farming.
Yes, I was down at Asilomar at the 39th Annual Eco Farm Conference, which we had a bunch of Resilience is Fertile brochures here at KSCO, and I picked one up and noticed that the ecofarm.org conference was happening, and I have been to this conference in the past, and I find it really interesting to hear what farmers are saying to each other.
These are modern day farmers. Are they like big farmers or small organic farmers, like you'd see at the farmers market?
Yeah, this group is historic in terms of having had a major effect on the development of organic farming for the country and for the world.
So they've been around a long time, this bunch.
They've been around for 39 years, and there's a lot of people there who look like they've been coming since the beginning. And one of the things they talk about is that the average age of American farmers, and we're talking about industrial farmers who make food that the rest of us eat, is 57 years old.
Oh my. So the youngsters aren't going for farming, are they?
Apparently not. The conference was very much about the fact that we need to be taking care of the soil, we need to be taking care of nature, we need to be understanding that it's very profitable to be farming organically.
That could be a good business to be in.
It's a very good business to be in. The margins are huge. And there was a keynote that went into how much the margins are huge by Dr. John Reginald.
What did he say?
He did an analysis of how the farm business works and standard farming practices, and how the argument is typically made that it's much more expensive to do organic farming, but it's not that much more expensive. The main expense is more labor. And the cost difference is very close. It's like 7 to 10% difference in cost. And the premiums are over 30% on average. And so he was showing what 30 years of business practices have demonstrated to be true, that organic farming is very profitable. It's on the rise, but it's still a very small percentage of all the farming that's being done.
Do they embrace technology at all from what you saw?
I didn't go to a lot of the nitty-gritty detail workshops, but these are people who really know the land. I mean, Santa Cruz is a mecca for organic farming. And there are groups that came right out of the University of Santa Cruz Organic Farm, which I guess it was the Chadwick Farm. It was started by the guy who wrote How to Grow More Vegetables. And to this day, that farm is managed by graduate students from UC, and they feed some of the students there. I was shocked to learn that they believe that 40% of the students at the university are what they call food challenged, and they can buy the organic food that's grown there on UC campus at UC
cost.
Yeah, at cost, basically.
Wow, that's pretty
good deal for those folks.
Wow. So the farm can help feed the students.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard a lot of students are also sort of homeless too. They live in their cars.
Yeah, I know.
Pretty extreme.
Right.
I can't imagine doing that as a student myself.
Yeah. I asked somebody why UC doesn't build housing for all their students, given how prohibitively expensive it is to live here. And, just the rumor mill is that whenever they try to, they run into a very adversarial planning department. So,
It's often red tape that slows things down. Because I've seen a lot of breakthroughs in the housing world too, like with tiny homes and 3D printers printing houses and this sort of thing. It seemed,
I think it has to do with them not being allowed to cut down any trees or you know, do any kind of development that challenges the ecology of the campus.
Of the land itself.
The land itself.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So, fascinating and informative conference, and I really came home with a lot of desire to do a garden this year.
You're going to have a garden?
I hope so. I think I need some help.
What do you want to grow?
Well, the things you grow in a garden are the things that are easy.
Spices?
Yeah, you start with herbs. I'm definitely going to start with herbs. Yeah. And then I'm going to do some tomatoes because those are very rewarding. They grow well here. And probably some peppers, some beans, ground squash, maybe zucchini.
Sustainable food.
Yeah. Things that you have to love being out in nature because it's not like you're saving money. Okay.
Yeah. So. Well, I got to ask you this question, though, as a growing and farmer. And I was wondering if there was any organic pot farmers there.
Well, I'm sure there were, but I'm not sure that I met them.
To you,
right? Right, hard to say. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. How big the event was it?
Oh, you mean how many people
were
attending? Well, I know the big hall at Asilomar was full. So how many does that hold? Several thousand.
That many?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a big event. It's been happening for a long time. It's very popular.
Wow. So. Okay. Yeah. Well, good. Well, thank you for that report, Mrs. Future.
My pleasure.
We're actually recording the show a little bit early because Dr. Future here might actually be in jury selection today.
Yeah, we're fully expecting that Dr. Future is recording his part of the show, in real time.
Yeah, in the event that I might actually have to be on a jury.
He's time traveling too, right now.
Yeah, and if you've ever been to the jury selection process, they make you turn off all your gadgets before you go into the courtroom.
So you can't even call in.
I know, it's amazing to me. Here we are, us geeks, literally spent our lives making sure everyone had a supercomputer in their pocket.
That's right, so that they can collapse those gaps like transportation and time.
And realize who we truly are and what we're capable of doing as a species. And they get banned from the criminal justice system.
Things like politics and justice are definitely the laggards when it comes to any kind of innovation or keeping up with the Joneses or utilizing new technology.
It's a difficult process to evolve, but it has evolved. The criminal justice system is evolving. I have faith that it will continue. It's still one of the best on the planet. It was really interesting, say the least, to experience what it's like to be in a courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what kind of tips do you have for people who are going to jury duty?
I would say to appreciate the process, you know, just to see this is how it is. This is how we've evolved it after 200 years, and it's going to go even further. I talked to one old man who said that the justice system was, back in the Cooper House, was the courtroom, that they would sometimes have the bailiff go out and grab people off the street for jury duty.
Wow.
So it has evolved.
This guy's an old timer, I take it, huh?
He's the one with the headset next to me that couldn't hear people half the time. That's the other problem. They didn't have wireless mics, and that is an issue.
They kept saying, speak up, speak up.
You couldn't hear them.
Would you like to borrow my mic?
It's a standing joke in the courtroom.
All right, well, hey, we got to go to a break. We'll be right back. Dr. Future Show.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show, or the Futures.
We be the ourselves? Futures.
Something like that.
Alan
the Futures.
Son.
Yeah, we need a theme song.
Okay, is that a request for suggestions?
Yeah, any suggestions? Let me know. Tuesday afternoon was good. I like that, the Moody Blues, but something more modern today might be fun. Okay, so the next story has to do with what was on 60 Minutes the other night. And it regarded how the entire USA intelligence network of spying is shifting.
Oh, yeah? I missed this. What happened?
Well, this very interesting 60 Minutes piece, but it's all about how a private company has launched the largest fleet of satellites in human history to photograph the Earth.
Oh, really? Yeah. They're going to trump Google?
So you could say
didn't
that.
They do that a while ago with Street View?
This is new pictures every day of the entire planet. High-resolution pictures every day.
Almost real-time, huh? And they can see
everything?
No blackout zones?
No. Well, I guess maybe there might be some But that's where the intelligence services come in, because they got to black out their zones from the public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, of course, that tells everybody where they all are.
All right. Who owns this private network?
It's a private company in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Planet.
Planet.
Yes.
All right.
And now it's interesting because before this revolution of tiny, cheap satellites that do high-res photography of the Earth every day and give us pictures that if you want to buy, you can. It's a business. You can sell high-resolution images. And who buys it? Well, farmers, as we were talking before. Farmers will look at their crops and see how they're doing. They can look every day and see if they're the right color, if they're flowering at the right time, if there's a disease, where it's located on their in their fields. They might have hundreds of acres.
So this idea is like farmers are vacationing at the seashore and looking through the internet at their
no,
farm
they can
back
be at home
in Idaho.
They could do that if they're smart. But most likely they'll be at their headquarters in Idaho near their farm.
Well, what's preventing them from just looking out at the farm then?
Because you can't see the whole thing.
Oh.
You know, no, this is huge. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right. And you'll be able to see in more detail how the crops are doing in each of the fields.
Mm-hmm.
That's core. It's getting cheap enough that companies, farm corporations, can afford that kind of technology.
So they're going to have subscriptions so that you can see certain parts of the planet that they're filming.
Yeah, you choose what you want to film. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you don't care about the entire planet. You want to know what your part of it is doing, the part of your ecosystem.
Yeah, the daily report
messing with
would be premium. Premium
right.
content. Because
yeah.
Otherwise you'd just look at Google Earth.
Yeah, exactly. A really interesting show.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting video
mm-hmm.
on 60 Minutes this week. I suggest you check it out.
Okay, I will
okay.
do that.
Now, what's
very
fascinating about that on the other side is the intelligence side was that, you know what they used before these small satellites were so readily available? Big satellites.
Trick question.
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, NSA,
these guys,
CIA, and you know all our intelligence networks have these, and still do, they have these massive cameras in space.
Mm-hmm.
They look like the Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
Only instead of looking at the out, they're looking in.
I see. Getting incredible detail, I guess.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, they're amazing. I think we have three or four of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're billions of dollars each.
Right.
So they're very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these Planet satellites, 1.2 million pictures every 24 hours.
Oh my goodness. How can we even
begin
to
process
that? They
have 200 customers so far.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, naturally, the spy agencies are buying the data.
I imagine they're...
from Planet. They're because it's, like, cheaper.
Some of the customers.
Yeah. So, there's an example of how things are shifting
mm-hmm.
in terms of military budgets and versus consumer technologies.
Wow.
That now involves space.
I wonder how the laws work when it's a private company providing the information, and then you'll have the government trying to control who gets access to it.
Well, there'll be all kinds
sort of reverse.
agencies within agencies, all with their job tasked to keep it balanced.
Well, it's like a reverse of the Facebook problem or the Google problem, where all of this information is being put out to the general public and people are so worried about their privacy because they don't want their information going out. Well, this is that there's so much public information being collected privately and the only people who can access it are the customers of that private company.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Uh-huh.
At least in a capitalist system, right, where uh-huh. we're making money on data.
Right.
NASA
does that
gets
mean...
their stuff for free. I mean, there's a lot of NASA stuff that you can just get.
That's right. Well, that's my point, is that it really puts premium data into the hands of people who pay.
Yeah, well, which is way more people than just intelligence agencies.
And it possibly creates a lack of access to that data on the part of people who can't pay or don't pay or who only have access to the free stuff. And the free stuff is blocked.
Pay to play.
Pay to play.
You know, it's still that word. But at least it's that. Mm-hmm. At least it's play. Before, you didn't have access at all.
That's true.
The intelligence agencies had satellites since 1960,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, we're just getting it.
Right.
So, yeah, it evens the playing
field. Let's be appreciative.
So even if it's just for, you know, people can afford it initially, it's better than nobody,
uh-huh.
unless you're part of the...
Well, we want access to the data, and we want access to the data to be as available as possible. And anybody who has the ability to ask for the data should get it.
Oh, yeah? You think it should be that free, huh?
I think that we want access to planetary knowledge. We want to be able to see our planet from above. We want to be able to understand our planet in a better way than we have before. And we want more complete information.
Personally?
I do, yeah. Uh-huh. Definitely.
Okay. So you want to see where the entrance to the super secret space program in Antarctica is located?
Of course I do.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Well, what do you think, folks? Should Mrs. Future be given access to such data?
The security concerns of the planet are my own security concerns as well.
Okay.
Given how much the population is full of trolls and people who are just menacing.
You want them to have access to all this data too?
No, I would really like to screen people who don't deserve it and people who will abuse it. So we definitely need some critical process for using data to our greatest advantage.
Okay then, well, I'll task you with that. Meanwhile, I'm moving on.
I'm open to suggestions.
Yeah, go ahead, regulate. I'm all for good regulation. How about de-extinction? There's an issue for regulators to deal with.
De-extinction? I can't even imagine what that means.
Well, this is another breakthrough. A lot of amazing technology. CRISPR-Cas9, you talked about genetic engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Well. It's now possible to take animals that have become extinct and bring them back, a la Jurassic Park.
Really? Are we bringing back some dinosaurs?
No. We're not bringing back any dinosaurs. One of our first de-extinctions looks like it will be the passenger pigeon.
Passenger pigeons?
Yes.
Oh, who doesn't like passenger pigeons?
Well, a lot of people didn't. Martha the passenger pigeon died in 1914 at the Cincinnati Zoo. That was the last one.
Oh, 1914,
Once the dominant species in eastern North America. They roam the forest and they have big flocks and several billions of individuals for tens of thousands of years all across North America.
Hmm.
Huge. Sheer number of them. It made them a big part of the ecosystem. See, that's what our ecologists are figuring out now, is that just those billions of birds and what they ate and pooped and did shaped the habitat dynamics of forests and the plains.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever the passenger pigeons were, they had a major impact on the ecosystem. Not just destroying it, but it forming it. Because they were there for thousands, if not millions of years, that species was actually creating the life forms that lived there.
Mm.
The sprouts that they ate, the trees that they had their nests in. All these things became serving of that particular species.
Uh-huh.
That became a big issue, whether or not we should bring back the passenger pigeon or anyone else, because the ecosystem has moved on. It's not like it was when the passenger pigeon was here.
Uh-huh.
It shifted. They haven't been around for generations. So now the forests have changed to a different type of flora and fauna than they were 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So should we bring back a species that needs different types of plants to grow for their food than that are there now? You know,
it's a really profound question.
I mean, because it shifts things. Yeah, it's a moving target. You know, the ecosystem is never static.
Hmm.
I think the big point of de-extinction is that it might not just bring back that species. It might require bringing back that ecosystem that species lived in.
That is what is most profound about our world, is we have to start seeing it in terms of ecosystems. We can't just focus on one piece. We have to focus on the whole environment and everything a part of it and the connections.
Yes, including us.
Including us.
Yeah.
And including our knowledge base and including all of the data that we're collecting.
So how do we get a good read on our ecosystem so we know we've got real data there?
Oh, we have to be a little more smart as we pay attention.
Sensors, I say.
Sensors!
Yes! Good sensors. We have access.
Instead of plastics, we need more sensors.
I love sensors.
We'll be back. Got to go to a break. See you soon, Dr. Future Show.
Okay, we're back. So, yes, the passenger pigeon, Mrs. Future.
Yes.
That was the topic of the singularity.
It makes me very curious about them because the drawing in this article makes them look like a very beautiful bird. And I wonder why they're called the passenger pigeon. What was the passenger?
What did they carry?
What did they carry? Were those the pigeons that they used to use for messages? But it seems like those pigeons would still be around.
Wait a minute. If they were passengers, they were on something else.
Oh.
Maybe they had some kind of species airplane. I'm serious.
This sounds like a case for Wikipedia.
Not a question of technology, because we know that our species is the technomeisters of this planet.
Yeah.
No, it was more something like they would be aware of wind currents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're a bird, you're a passenger of the winds.
Oh, I see.
That's what I was thinking.
So they knew the wind patterns.
Yeah. Yeah, they would. Birds would kind of know that sort of stuff. Their bird brains would be knowing the behavior of where they can fly.
Well, I was thinking of homing pigeons, which were used for communications for centuries before there was different kinds of long-distance communications.
Yes, I think even Marco Polo and Kublai Khan used passenger pigeons.
Were those passenger pigeons also known as
homing pigeons? No, they were using homing pigeons.
Yes.
You're right. Passenger, I don't know. Maybe. Uh-huh. That would be the time when they were around.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm curious. I'm going to look it up.
How
not right
far
now.
Spread the passenger pigeon was. You know, good questions, Mrs. Future.
This article is about reintroducing them from a CRISPR-Cas9 update.
Yeah.
You want to take existing pigeons and take some of the genes from the extinct species and mutate the current species into the old species.
That's how they do it. Yeah.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's not just trying to
it's ironic.
Collect DNA from the original passenger pigeon. No, mm-hmm. no, no. You modify the evolution of modern-day pigeons.
Right.
And you can do that by, you look at the evolution of the brainstem.
Mm-hmm.
You can see all the creatures through time in the embryo as it's coming through to become a pigeon or become a human, for that matter. There's a whole process. Where it's like a time machine, you know, as you look at the evolution of the embryo.
Yeah, what's that saying they say?
Antogeny
that
recapitulates phylogeny.
There you go.
It's a 19th century insight.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say that would lead itself well to a nice VR thing, to be able to look at embryonic development in VR, in 3D.
Yeah.
You know, it would be just evolutionarily interesting.
Right, to see a little fetus go through all the stages of being a cell, and then a tadpole, and then a fish, and then a creature with a spine, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, sort of adding all the knowledge we know.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
The other thing you might be able to do is that if you want to reawaken, shall we say, extinct species, you could create a habitat just for them somewhere else.
This is Jurassic Park in a nutshell.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You could really do Jurassic Parks. Like, we kind of have them already. If you think of the Galapagos Islands, for example, the Galapagos Islands were isolated from the rest of civilization, so they developed
unique species,
right. They had, you know, unique iguanas and tursi turtles and
dodo birds who then became extinct.
Fine example of something that could be brought back, the dodo bear and the dodo bird ecosystem, whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have them in remote islands or perhaps even in space colonies.
Mm-hmm.
You send them outside of this planet because they are a mutation.
Sure, once they leave this planet, evolution is a wild card.
Yeah, I'd say actually that's probably the best use for extinct species is just to send them out in space. They might take hold somewhere. You know, it might be a nice seed pod from our planet to send not just our species, but all species out into the universe.
Mm.
See what happens?
Mm.
Till somebody stops us. We're not. The latest polarization in this is amazing.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean? What kind of polarization are you talking about?
Well, I'm thinking that there are scientists that believe that the universe is full of life.
Yes.
And it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other scientists that, strictly by the numbers, if they look at the possibility of how, whether or not life could have evolved as we understand life to be, as biology, biological life, that the chances of biological life existing in the universe are less than the number of stars in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the number is infinitesimally small. For life to even exist at
all. Because it's such a unique thread of coincidences that caused this form of life to be here now.
And that's so small. That's so small that then for it to spread and how hard it is to go between star systems would be almost insurmountable and be
another infinitesimally small number. So this is the opposite of the Drake equation.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a number of scientists looking strictly at the numbers and trying to figure this out by random chance. That is like insane that to think we even exist.
I see. Yeah. So
it's just the odds of us existing are just so infinitesimal. That it's unimaginable. I think they call them the Penrose numbers.
Oh, I see. So Penrose means we should count our blessings. We're lucky to be here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is
make every day count.
Miracle. Yeah.
Whereas the Drake equation is like there are so many planets and so many stars. There must be planets that we don't know about that have life forms evolving just as much as just like us.
Yeah, the chances are good that life could be elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So there's this polarization in science that's quite fascinating to me.
Right.
You know, and then there's the film, I Am. Remember that film, I Am?
Yes, yes.
About that famous filmmaker who traveled around the world to figure out really what's going on here.
Yes.
You know, he had done some big films.
The producer of Ace Ventura.
Yeah, Ace Ventura,
Pet
Detective.
Jim Carrey.
Scafley.
Sardovsky.
So, yeah. Anyway, we'll think of it.
Yeah.
Worthwhile film, I Am. And it brings up the other idea where science meets shamanism.
Mm-hmm. One of your favorite themes.
One of my famous themes. I see him in that film. And it had to do with the idea that the Earth and the planets and the galaxies are alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're alive. And what does that mean? What does it mean to have a living universe?
What does it mean?
Yeah, it means nothing right now to most people because they're doing their daily tasks and feeding their families and getting things done. But what it means is that it responds to you.
Mm-hmm.
That the world around you is interactive and will respond to you. That's why people talk about asking for what you want. Ask the universe for what you want.
Well, sort of intention gathers energy for manifestation.
Yeah.
That's how I take that idea. It's not just magic. It's not just that because you want it and you say a prayer then it suddenly happens. It's actually that there's a process that brings it about that starts with thoughts and then goes into efforts and then results in actions. There's an accumulation
the
of
thoughts
making
actions.
It happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, thoughts drive the process.
Exactly.
But efforts make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, and the alignment of the two
needs
to happen. You know, they said, oh, I'll do that. No, that's a good idea. Let's do that.
Right.
You know, hence we have lots of great inventions to play with these days.
Right.
Which reminds me.
Tom Shadyac.
Tom Shadyac. Great autobiographical story of his life. And going from a feature filmmaker, working with some of the most amazing characters in Hollywood, Ace Ventura himself, to
making the movie I Am,
which
is his philosophical assessment of the values of the world that we're in and how striving for success in a world that separates us from feeding everyone might not be the highest ethical use of our time.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But he did bring up the idea that it's a living universe in that film, too. And
that's
one of many films that I suggest you check if you're curious more about this concept, shall we say.
Yeah.
Let's get into one of the ways to deal with these ecosystems if they do get out of whack.
Okay.
Okay, like we have a problem right now with Galapagos.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the islands called Seymour Norte, it's a small one, 455 acres, a part of the Galapagos. It's a unique ecosystem. It's one of the smaller islands of the Galapagos. And there are lots of very interesting, strange birds and lizards there, hatchlings, iguanas. And what happened is that some rats from an island not too far away swam there.
Wow, really?
Swam there, and started feasting on all the different eggs.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And started multiplying.
Must and be devastating the, to oh, the totally local devastating population.
To the level local, totally devastating.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that? Yeah, that's been a big problem with the ecologists.
Don't use mongoose.
No, don't bring mongoose like in Hawaii.
Shows us.
Doesn't work.
Right. Yeah. Rats are nocturnal.
So what they're trying now mm-hmm. is drones.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking big drones. They can carry like 40-pound loads mm-hmm. and bringing various rodent poisons and dropping them in the areas where the rodents seem to be congregating.
Hmm, that sounds a little dicey as well. How do you know you're not going to poison the wrong people, the wrong species?
Well,
anyway,
let's get more
gotta
to that
go
after
to a break.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, welcome back to the show, folks. Yeah, we're just talking about these use of drones. The use of drones to eradicate invasive species.
Right. On delicate ecosystems, like the yes. Galapagos.
Yes, like these rats that have swum to one of the smaller islands, Seymour Norte. Sounds like a name of a person, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And this apparently is the second time they got there.
Mm-hmm.
The first time they had to be eradicated. And this time, they're using drones. I think the first time was helicopter, but it was very expensive. But the second time, it's now drones.
This what is, did they use? They used the helicopter to drop poison?
Well, helicopters are used for this type of task as well.
I see.
Yeah, if you have to drop a lot of poison or payload or whatever, and you've got to be very specific about where you put them, because you don't want to hurt the other species. When you're trying to take out a species, you want to go to where their habitats are and hit those.
Hmm.
That where they gather, or where they, not where the other birds are that are nesting, and you want to leave them alone. You don't want to make sure none of the poison goes there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my main concern, because I know we have used poison, which I only did one time when we first moved into our house, and we had a very pernicious wood rat. I thought, okay, we're going to use some poison, and I was very surprised that about 6 months after the rat died of poison, there was an outbreak of flies in our vents. So the rat died somewhere in the house, and then all these flies came out of it.
In the wall or something?
Yeah. And, of course, the big concern of using poison is that other animals eat the dead rats, and then you kill the other animals.
Like,
you have to be careful.
Yeah, like bobcats or even feral cats. And
or birds or, you know, rats are
skunk
preyed upon by many creatures.
Right. Tasty morsels.
Owls.
Yeah, birds.
Creatures you don't want to kill.
Yes, poison has its ecosystem too, doesn't it?
It does. It sure does.
Well, they don't go into much detail on this Wired article on the topic about the kind of poison, but I'm sure that they've thought about that, and they probably, they need to, because we certainly have that among our friends. We have friends who live in the woods and often need to catch mice and rats.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an issue because a lot of people do live capture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they take those rodents and move them so that it becomes someone else's problem, which
isn't really very
ecological. I think the cat solution is probably the best.
Yeah,
put some mousers out and let them take care of the rats.
Yeah, I'd say a lot of Boulder Creekers are definitely into that.
Yeah.
That definitely works. And I must say, we have gone electric ourselves with this.
Yeah, we believe in-house the way to deal with rodents is zappers.
Yes, it works quite well.
Yeah, I bear them no malice outside the house. I feel like it's a natural environment. They're allowed to live. But inside the house, they're not allowed to live because they do not respond to me telling them to stop making noise and stop chewing holes. So they're out.
All right. So there you go. So
they get zapped.
So what do you think? Maybe they should drop zappers on Galapagos to get the rats, because it works.
I trust people who are studying the situation.
Instead of poison.
I believe what this article is saying, that they are very careful in their use of poison.
Where they put it,
Where they put it. Also, apparently, they make it blue, which they believe is a color that rats will consume, but other animals won't. So, I admire their ingenuity. Well, if it works, let's use it. But let's be mindful of the consequences for the rest of the ecosystem. Let's not just be focused on killing the rats.
a complicating factor, according to this article, is that this war against invasive species is not quite like a typical human war, where you might win, sign a treaty, and the two nations go about their business. Mm-hmm. No. When you're fighting invasive species, you need constant vigilance.
Yeah, because they don't sign any contracts or treaties. That's not the way it works. Although there are those who believe you can speak to the spirits of the animals and that you can make friends with them.
Well, you should have a couple of those people there too, I think.
Yeah. I think that's what wizards used to be in the Middle Ages. They were the people who could, you know, telepathically create deals with the animals.
Well, the sad reality is that very few islands on the planet are safe from human-introduced invasive species at this point.
Mm.
And even a remote island, I mean, the most remote, all it takes is one pregnant rat swimming from one shipwrecked vessel to throw an entire ecosystem into chaos.
Hmm.
One.
Right.
Well, Jones can't fix all the misses we're having. At least they can start winning small battles.
Okay. What does that look like?
That looks like using drones to drop zappers.
Drappers and blue pills.
Well, yeah, the thing is about zappers, you'd have to pick them up later. That's why we now have claws for the drones.
But don't you have to pick up the poison later, too?
Do you? No. You had a good point about the poison, how other animals will eat the dead rats, and then that will be...
Oh, I sold you on that one.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Good.
No, it makes sense to me. So you want to avoid that if possible. If you don't want...
Unintended consequences.
Birds picking at the carcasses of the rats and getting sick themselves. No, you don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if those birds belong there.
Mm-hmm.
You either want to kill them and pick them up, you know, and that's where the claws come in too, because the drone claws can now pick up simple things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So you like the zapper solution the best, because then you can use your drone claw.
Yeah, you zap them and then you pick them up with the drone claw.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay.
It's a brave new world, Mrs. Future.
I see. Awesome.
Electricity is clean. No muss, no fuss.
Far out.
That's a great article in Wired. I definitely recommend it if you want to know more about this ecosystem problem in Galapagos.
Mm-hmm. I'll try and keep this brief, but I am fascinated by the concept of rodent control in an ecosystem conscious way and how to be the kind of human who is stewarding the ecosystem. So if you're out there trying to make life more abundant and make things grow more fruitfully, one of the most profound things they said at the EcoFarm conference was said by an indigenous elder who introduced the conference. And he was talking about that when the indigenous people plant something or exist in an ecosystem, they believe that every plant has a responsibility to feed all the creatures in the ecosystem. So,
okay, well, you know, I'm all for feeding the mice, but...
Not just the mice, the bugs, the soil, the micronutrient
culture.
I'll tell you what,
I also believe that we, as a conscious species, can help evolve the ecosystem to make it better.
How do we do that?
Well, one of the ways is that, let's take the rat problem, for example. Everyone can relate to that.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone.
Right. Yeah,
cities, country.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, don't you pause to think about it? Don't you find it kind of interesting that they are medical science's main and go-to animal for finding out about our system and how we work?
Sure.
That the lowly rat
and
mouse is teaching us more about ourselves than just about animals, and sacrificing themselves by the millions so we can learn about ourselves?
Yeah,
but we're making them too. That you can argue that we're breeding them like rats, basically for research.
Yeah.
Very nice purebred ones for different types of experiments.
Well, in the words of Yogananda, we are living on predator planet. Everything eats something.
Yeah. So I would say that what we could do, if we wanted to, is that we could retrain the rats, because they turned out to be very smart also.
Mm-hmm.
They're very intelligent. Like our pigs are very smart, like dogs, you know, on the level of our smart animals.
How are you going to retrain every generation of rats? Don't they have a new generation every few months?
Well, I think that they live really close to us, okay? So they're in our homes already.
Mm-hmm.
So all we have to do is really communicate with the ones that are in our houses. And the way we do that is we use a robot.
robots training the animals again. Okay.
Yes, it is the best way, from what I can see.
Right.
Because the robots can be designed to go to where the mice live.
So what are you going to use, a Roomba?
It's too big. Maybe that would be the mothership.
Uh-huh. You can teach these rats to get a ride on a Roomba?
Well, I think we can teach them not to eat our food.
How can you teach them that?
You teach them what food they can eat. You send them to an area.
Do you think that they have any sense of getting your permission for what they eat? Doesn't work that way.
Do you ever train rats in a maze?
I have never trained rats in a maze, but it's my belief that nature imbues every creature with a sense of how it needs to feed itself.
I agree, but I think if you control the food sources, you control the species.
Okay, so how are you going to control the food sources? What's your strategy here?
My strategy is to have the robots teach them where they can get food. And where they can, and what they have to do to get the food.
They're gonna have a sign like arrow food over here.
Well, right. Stitcher, we know
quick,
a lot about.
Go to a break.
Okay, let's just say we know a lot about training those little critters.
Uh huh.
And none of that knowledge is being used for improving our relationship with them. And I say we use the science.
You want the same
we know about mouse training.
That shows
give it
us
to our AI robots,
uh-huh.
And they will then get smarter and smarter mice.
So you want
that are friendly with us for creating a better future between us and our pests.
Okay, well,
you know, it goes
the ones
from a pest
living in our house
to,
might not be as smart as the ones in the lab.
I mean, it can't be any worse than it is now. Pest relationship. It's going to be better than what could be better than a pest.
It'd be very interesting to see you test it out.
Maybe not a pet. Maybe not quite a pet level, but an animal ally of some sort.
I see. That's what you want to do. Stay tuned. We'll be back.